Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And this is The Food Fight, a frank discussion of food culture featuring Australia's top chefs, producers and experts.
We'll chat about real issues and go places others won't.
This podcast travels throughout the country and we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather and speak.
And we pay respect to elders past, present and emerging.
This one's another great Stock Takes episode. We're joined by sommelier, writer and gourmet traveller drinks columnist Samantha Payne to talk about food critics in a post-COVID world, Noma finally getting its third Michelin star and the usual jibber jabber about things we see on the internet. Enjoy. Here we are. Another Food Fight podcast, another Stock Takes episode featuring the lovely Samantha Payne. Sam, thank you so much for joining us again. It's absolutely awesome to have you on.
Hi, friends.
Hello.
Good to be here with you guys, at least in spirit, if not in person.
Yeah, you've got by far the best background to you. Like Steph.
Yeah. My office setup.
Yeah, Steph's just in his bedroom.
Yeah. Like working 12, out of my bedroom down
a
here 12 year old coast.
12 year old gamer.
Yeah, when I finish with this, I troll Miley Cyrus on TikTok.
You got to get through.
Sam, how's things? How's Sydney life? Simon's in Wollongong, in between Wollongong and Bangalore. I'm isolated down here on the south coast, but how's this most recent lockdown been for you?
I mean, time has no meaning anymore. I don't really know what day it is. It's funny. I was just talking to a mate in the UK before we all jumped online and he asked the same thing. And it's weird. I mean, when the lockdown first hit, me and when I talked to Stu Knox at Fix and everyone else, we were like, yep, this will be 2 weeks, three maybe. It's not going to go any longer than four. And we're now, 12 weeks in, and it'll be another month before we're actually officially out of our homes in any sort of dining, drinking capacity.
Mm.
It's so surreal. It is not how I thought 2021 was going to roll.
A lot of those 2020, late 2020 tweets about 2021 being everyone's year have not aged well.
No,
badly, if anything. I think that's the worst thing, though, is not knowing. We'd like, even with the New South Wales lockdown, originally it was like a week, and we were like, oh, it's only a week, which was very, you know, very optimistic of us. But yeah, not knowing for so long how long it's going to be, at least now we have some idea and it feels a bit better.
Yeah. It's light at the end of the tunnel, but because we can see, because there's an end date now, because there's a finishing point, everyone's getting really antsy and really restless. It's like, oh, we're there, but we're not just there yet. So look, it's okay. I mean, I can only speak for myself, and I am extremely fortunate, but I've been bonkers busy with everything that I've been doing. So I've been eternally thankful and grateful for that, because there are a lot of my compadres that are not in the same boat.
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, that's good. I think that's probably something I need to remind myself of, the fact that I've still got a job and I'm still busy is a great thing as well. And Simon, you seem pretty busy as well. So
yeah, now I am.
At least we're all still working.
Yeah.
Anyway, does anyone remember, this is a complete aside, but does anyone remember when the Dole used to be called the John Howard Surf Team?
The what?
What? I'm just relating it to people down here. So this was back when people were on Newstart or whatever it was called back then, or the Dole, and it was when John Howard was our Prime Minister, and they used to call it the John Howard Surf Team, which basically meant that you just get money off the government and go surfing and not pay a thing. I've started hearing the Scotty Surf Team coming up a little bit when it comes to JobKeeper and disaster payments and things like that. People who've lost their jobs saying that they're on the Scott Morrison Surf Team. Anyway.
Love it.
I mean, if it wasn't winter time, I would be more amenable to that phrase. But
one of the only things,
I see some sunshine now.
Mm. All right. Okay. Sorry about that stupid aside. Should we get into it?
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. Well, let's start with Sam's got a story to talk about. Let's start with that story, Sam. Do you want me to introduce it? Do you want to introduce the one that you suggested for us to talk about?
Oh, sure. We're really getting into the thick of it early.
Getting straight into it.
Straight into it. No mussing around. Okay. Mm. So what I wanted to sort of wax lyrical about was, you know, there was a post that John Lethelin did on Instagram, as he always announces his stories via Instagram for most of us that don't subscribe to The Australian and want to pay to get behind the paywall. And he did a review on a restaurant in Perth, and it was scathing, for want of a better word. Mm. And, you know, then the comments from everybody in the industry and out of the industry sort of went on and sort of discussed. And it made me think about what our industry is going to be like post-pandemic, because there's going to be some struggling to get back to where we were or in the height of where we were. Yes, there'll be that initial bounce back of everybody just wanting to get out of their homes and wanting to get out. But, you know, from a tourism point of thing, it's going to take at least 6 months, because TAS and WA have announced that they're not going to allow, you know, anyone in or out till 2022. So we're going to be relying on local guests. And I guess the question I had was that kind of reviewing, where it is scathing and where it is, I guess, negative, for want of a better word, is there really a place for it in an industry that's going to be struggling to get back on its feet and that's struggling to find staff?
100%. I think.
Maybe we should rewind and just give a little bit more detail into some of the criticisms of the article and some of the things that we're talking about. And I guess your question, Sam's an interesting one as well, which is, what's it going to look like in a post-COVID world? And I think it's worth noting that this review's taken place in a COVID's happening right now world. It is in Western Australia, which is a bit different. And I suppose, like, we're looking at from the perspective of, you know, people living in New South Wales under lockdown. So our perspective might be a little bit different, you know, viewing it from over here. But in terms of the details of the article, the main gripe of the article is about a waiter that was too casual and quirky and kept on sitting next to the guests to talk about the food or the menu or the weather or whatever. So I just wanted to ask both of you, how do you guys feel about being sat next to? Because it's probably happened to all of us. Are you thumbs up, thumbs down? Depends on the context. What do you reckon?
It depends on the person. Like, some people could just get away with stuff like that. If you are that person, knowing whether you're that person who can get away with it is the hard part. So, I mean, really it's up to his, you know, the bosses, or, you know, this guy might have been told that that's how they do it. Like, he might have been said, you know, go sit by the guests, lean over the table, say hi, guys. So really, this poor fella has got a lot of criticism in a national newspaper from a very well-known, high-profile journalist, when it's not really his fault and his job to set the service. It would be the person in charge. So whether I enjoy it or not, I think it's very dependent on lots of things.
Mm.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I mean, I agree that it's more of a context thing. Like, if it was a friend of mine, absolutely. And that even may that service style may even change again in a post-COVID landscape where you won't want to get so close to not only other diners, but the people in the service industry, shall we say, because of all the reasons that COVID brings. but again, I don't think it's the same. It's the same thing of when people critique wine lists, and to bring it back to a context that I can actually explain is wine lists with theme, or if you, as a sommelier, our job is to create a wine list that suits the restaurant by which we've created it for, because of food, because of where it is, all the rest of it. Someone, critic or not, could come in and have an opinion about that wine list. Does that mean that I'm going to change said wine list because one person did not like it? They couldn't find a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc or whatever it is that they're into? No, because I don't answer to them. I answer to the person that's paying my check.
I think restaurants, people seem to have this idea that restaurants need to serve them. And as hospitality venues, we don't have to do anything for anyone if we don't want to. If we don't want to, you know, if you want to have a wine bar that doesn't serve any Sauv Blanc, you can do that. It's up to the customer to decide whether they want to come in. So that kind of weird thing of
being not, everything to everyone.
Well, yeah, and going possible. Somewhere and then seeing their style and then complaining about the style. It's like, well, you know, like I've got the article up here because I do actually pay for the Australian. And like one bit that sort of I thought was an odd thing. It says, now I'm not a formal person, but by the third time my goat had been got, my guest, a genial individual who wouldn't make a fuss about anything, is pissed off. Like, that's pretty, like, would that really piss you off? Like, would that be so so annoying that you'd be like someone who doesn't even get pissed off that much would be like, oh well, he sat down again. Now I'm pissed. Like, it just seems a bit over the top, really.
Especially when that's the style of the restaurant. Like, yeah, and they've said that this is how we want a relaxed style. That's okay if that's not for you, but you can't then mark them down points for doing what they were told to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it's a tough, I think that it's like a very tough situation that these types of venues, these sort of like upper class, like sort of fine casual wine bar, good food, but relaxed style neighborhood restaurants find themselves in when it comes to setting a service standard, because it's like, you're going to have a diversity of customers, which ranges from people having a formal business, you know, dinner or something like that, to, you know, people who you probably know that also work in hospital that are already pissed, that just want to eat snacks and drink wine. And of course you can sit next to them and things like that. Like, if you're running a three hat venue that like Key or something, like, you can train all your staff to serve everyone exactly the same, basically, because it's a formal place and it's a special occasion. And of course you're going to say, you know, read the room a bit, but like, this is our style. But when it comes to those casual places, the hardest thing to train in staff is being able to read the customer and to what extent you can go in terms of your sort of familiarity and casualness and all that sort of thing. And, you know, we don't know much about who this waiter was. But if you want to just, you know, try to train your staff in the limited time that you have to do proper, like really good floor staff training, and say, look, we want to have a casual style, and, you know, it doesn't matter if you sit next to them and stuff like that. If they take that on board and have a go at it, I don't know. I think, like you say, Simon, if you get pissed off by it as a as a customer, and if you really have the shits with that, I don't know. Maybe it's just a bit uptight. I don't know.
I think I feel there's always been a bit of an unwritten rule in reviews. It's even something that when someone calls out someone personally on like TripAdvisor, that really gets people up. And he's kind of called this guy out. Like, he's even said, in like the second paragraph, it's like, slumped on the banquet is our waiter, someone considered quirky, apparently. Like, that's pretty rough. And I think that I've very rarely seen that in reviews before, where someone has called me out. Like, I think commenting on the service as a whole is one thing, and that's valid. But sort of picking on a single person and kind of making that the main part of your article, that just seems a bit of a no-go.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Mm.
Do you think that the way that our media is distributed and the way that social media works these days plays into the possible sensationalizing of these sorts of things a little bit, and sort of writing that article in a way that means that it will generate comments and, you know, will gain some chatter from online and comment sections, and then people like us on a podcast
playing right into it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, do you think that the nature of the way that we consume media now changes the, you know, the way that these articles are authored?
Yeah. I mean, 100%. You know, there's a reason why there was that whole, you know, they call it clickbait. And I'm not saying that's what this is, but there's a huge problem with that on the internet. You know, when things, you know, in the early 2000s, when things started to change into advertorial and things like that, there were extra bonuses for the amount of clicks on articles. Now that's evened out a little bit now, but of course you're going to get more eyeballs on it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's always been a thing, less so in Australia, but in the UK and US, like bad reviews are almost more common than good ones, because they want that and people want to read that. And they're the most read ones. Like, I think Jay Rayner from the UK has a whole book, just his bad reviews, which I generally think are quite fair, to defend him a little bit. But like, he didn't, you know, he's not going to make money selling a book full of, I'd say not going to make money selling a book of good reviews. That is The Good Food Guide. So maybe you can. Sorry.
Sorry.
Chefs and foodies buy it. But yeah, like, so I think it's always been a problem. And now, it obviously, just with the internet and social media, it's even quicker from published to sensationalism.
But you made the point earlier, you know, pre-recording, about how Jay Rayner generally goes after bigger targets.
He sort of punches up.
Yeah, punches up. You know, he's not going after small guys for finicky, nitpicky things.
Yeah.
And that's why Jay Rayner is so widely, you know, acclaimed.
So, yeah, definitely think that's... Yes, Steph?
Do you think, Simon, that there is a bit more separation between critic and proprietor / chef / front of house manager, you know, in terms of their relationships in Europe as compared to Australia? It seems like most critics here in Australia know most hatted chefs and stuff, you know, on a level that's more personal than just going into a restaurant. Like, when Jay Rayner walks into Lestrance in Paris or something like that, it's probably not as much of a familiar sort of like, hey, how's it going, mate, kind of relationship with the staff as might be here in Australia.
That does seem quite apparent in Australia. I think, like, Jay Rayner seems to be pretty popular, but there's the critic who reviews for The Guardian, whose name I cannot quite remember. She is completely anonymous. Like, she won't let any photo come out. There's never a photo in the paper. So she sort of takes it, you know, very serious in a way that she wants to be completely anonymous when she reviews. So I think there's definitely, and I think there's some similar in America. But yeah, there's definitely a bit of a, which I think is a nice thing in some ways. So it is quite friendly, buddy, buddy in Australia with certain people. So I think there's a difference there.
That's interesting with the anonymous review. Sorry to interrupt you, Simon. Is that, like, we've got anonymous reviewers in Australia in the Good Food Guide, but we've got none that write bad reviews that are anonymous?
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting point. That, yeah, you'd maybe feel even more aggrieved if you didn't know when they were in and sort of where they get and what they had and their interaction. So, I mean, it's always a bit of a difficult one. I think, going back to the sort of the original point, was when hospitality has been completely fucked for 18 months, almost 2 years now, should you be writing bad reviews? Could he have just not written that review? Like, I'm not saying write a good review and lie, but could he have reviewed somewhere else? Could he have, you know, just not done a negative one? Could he have written that review without, you know, picking on an individual member of staff? Would that be more positive given right now?
Sam?
I mean, I would hope so. I would think that would be the way to go, because once you start pulling at that thread, there might not be that many restaurants left. Mm. You know, they're already, I know you guys mentioned it on the last podcast, but we're already getting trolled on the internet just for following government health.
Just for opening back up
with the rules that we've been mandated that we have to follow. We're already getting trolled for that. Do we really need it from fellow industry people?
Yeah.
At this point in time.
I think that the tough one is really heavily criticizing service. And I know that, like, you know, this was a sort of a different aspect of service, but, you know, other things were mentioned and stuff as well. But, like, I mean, yeah, perhaps, like, you know, the chef can be in control of the food and the produce and things like that. But the fact that it's just so hard to find good staff these days, we've lost our entire overseas, you know, workforce, and it's just few and far between. Again, it might be different in WA than it is here, but, like, I think, you know, it's going to be a big problem here for a long time. So to really go after service in a review, like, to make service the main thing, it's a difficult one.
Admittedly, your service very much relies on an interaction with a person, so it's probably not the easiest thing to write a review without sort of mentioning someone. I imagine it can be done. You two are the writers, you tell me. But you would have to sort of work around a little bit. So I get that inherently it's an interaction with a person. So I guess that's tough. But yeah, it's just it feels a bit unsavory. It feels a little bit yuck. Feels like punching down.
Yeah, I suppose that's the other thing. It's like, I think that there is still definitely places for bad reviews and stuff like that. And, you know, like, neither you nor I, Simon, thought that, you know, Eater having a bit of a crack at 11 Madison Park's vegan menu was like, they've just been through COVID, how dare they, sort of thing.
Fair point.
But, like, when, I don't know, it just seems a bit different when it's a neighborhood restaurant, a small business and things like that, rather than, like, I think that it would be much easier with me with, you know, the first review of Claire Smythe's new place in Sydney not being great than, you know, this a new neighborhood wine bar that's just opened up to receive the same criticism for some reason. I don't know.
Yeah, I get it. So we need to have a list. That then
for me, like, using that as an example, that then for me brings in the relevance for it all. Because let's say Claire Smythe's new joint and someone of notoriety puts out a negative review. Is that actually going to stop any one of us or any one of the public going to check it out?
Yeah, I think that's why we didn't even consider it with 11 Madison Park, because we knew it wasn't going to make any difference to their bookings. People were going to go either way. A smaller restaurant that's lesser known, that could have legitimate impact on their bookings.
Consequences.
Yeah, but
I think that this article will do. On Heritage Wine Bar, you know, like, to get a 2 out of 5 and to basically tell the Perth public that the place is shit is like,
yeah, yeah.
But it was also interesting in the comments of people being like, yeah, oh, I've been before and I loved it, or I've been twice and both times have been great, and I tried to book in for the Saturday night and it was already booked out. So
well, yeah, let's hope the old adage of there's no bad publicity, let's hope that it, you know, fires enough people up to go again and to tell their friends and everything else. So yeah, we can definitely hope that, but it's still just a worry at this time when businesses are closing and people's livelihoods are being lost, that someone who, you know, although they may kind of think or claim that they're outside the industry like a lot of critics do, their livelihood is dependent on us having restaurants and having bars. So if they close us all down, they're pretty fucked.
Nothing to review if nothing's open.
You're like, finally.
A dream job.
My work here is done.
Yeah. All right. Well, should we move on to the next news item?
Yeah. You want to talk Noma?
Yeah, go for it. You started off, Simon.
Noma, that little restaurant in Copenhagen, it's been around for knocking around for a bit, went and got themselves 3 Michelin stars, which was quite a surprise, I think, for a lot of people. So if you didn't know, Noma hasn't never had 3 stars. There's always been 2, even though they've topped the world's 50 best multiple times. They're probably, you know, top 5 or 10 most influential restaurants. Definitely the restaurant of this generation has spawned countless chefs and countless further stars. People who have worked there have gone on to win 3 stars. And poor Rene just hasn't managed to get it for whatever reason. So, and it's been a bit of a knock on Michelin, and there's been rumors of, you know, they didn't want to let the top 50 influence them, and whether Noma was a Michelin star or 3 Michelin star style of restaurant. So lots of kind of things over the years, but I think people have just sort of stopped worrying about it. So the announcement came as a bit of a surprise, especially in a year where, you know, a year ago, Noma were doing burgers.
So, by all accounts, they were delicious.
Yeah.
They're amazing.
Yeah, imagine amazing burgers. So it just seems, and I wonder whether Michelin were maybe using this year to sneak it under the carpet to sort of write a decade of wrongs, maybe. So bit of an interesting one, and just fuels more of the Michelin intrigue and hate and confusion, I think.
What do you think prevented Noma from getting Sam? Like, where do you see that line with Michelin and Noma only sitting on 2 stars for the last however long? Is this just the sort of the stuffiness of old school European expectations for what 3 Michelin stars means?
I would agree with that sentiment of in their eyes, they were like, well, here are the certain boxes that you have to tick. Here's the criteria. This is the way that we see it. This is the way that we've always seen it. This is the bar kind of thing. I think, and someone, it was either in a comment on Instagram or it was in a piece that was written about it, someone had mentioned that maybe they came to their senses because in a lot of ways there isn't really Copenhagen dining without Noma.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Influx of people going to Copenhagen, not only for Noma, but then to see the scene around it, that the nebulous that they are a part of.
Yeah, I think without Noma, there's not 1,000 restaurants with tan wooden chairs and wooden tables. So
natty
ones, which I mean, like is silly, but like it's kind of true. Like they spawned and influenced a whole generation of not even just like chefs and food of restaurant settings and service and
what wine can be served. Like a real like collection of restaurants and vibes and, you know, all of that.
Mm, yeah.
In a response or in a bit of a statement, cryptic explanations from Michelin folks saying it's about the food. We're very strict and inflexible in our criteria, which is sort of like a response to why haven't Noma received a Michelin star, 3 Michelin stars in the past. Simon, you've got a better understanding of Michelin than I do, having worked in Europe and all that sort of stuff. Like, do you think that the criteria of the Michelin guide, if they aren't recognizing, you know, for the last decade or however long, if they're not recognizing Noma's contribution to the hospitality industry and their innovation and, you know, being the restaurant of a generation, if they're not including that in their criteria for giving 3 Michelin stars, are they a bit behind the times? Because it seems, you know, you can basically list the ingredients that are on a classic three Michelin star menu with your lobsters and your foie gras and your caviars and all those sorts of ingredients and things like that. I mean, the innovation that Noma's shown over the years is just above and beyond that style of dining. Like, do you think that Michelin criteria is a bit outdated?
Yes. Like, Michelin, like especially three-star restaurants, have always, the joke's always been it's a list of restaurants where rich people can eat caviar and truffles and foie gras. And I mean, it still is that. You still see restaurants in the UK and they still look so old school compared to Australia from plating, from settings, from the dining room. But it's kind of copycat world where if you want to win three stars, you look at everyone else who's got three stars. So I guess the chefs do perpetuate it themselves as well. But they've always been slow, and it's such a mission, such a massive thing now. And they've got guides all around the world, and you know, they very much seem to go now when they do a new guide, it's where they're going to, you know, sell guides, which is fair enough. But very much influenced by the money. I mean, there's a reason they haven't come to Australia, because it's probably not worth it financially to them, even though we've got some, you know, some of the best restaurants in the world. So yeah, it's outdated, and they've sort of feigned to try and update it by, like, you know, having that little Hawker Chan restaurant or fucking shack in Hong Kong get a star, and it was like the cheapest star restaurant, and some other kind of like less likely three stars. But it does just seem like they've had a bit of a blind spot, or maybe they're just stubborn. Maybe they're just stubborn French people.
But does this mean that they're not being that stubborn anymore? Like, have they changed the criteria slightly, or has Noma's food gotten to three Michelin star level somehow?
Yeah, it happens quite often where, like in the UK especially, like there's always someone who everyone is expecting to get their third star. And it's almost feels like an ordained. Like, but when I was, you know, young chef, it was Marcus Waring. Like, he was going to get his third star. Oh, it's got to be this year. It's got to be next year. And obviously, he's gone before that. There's a restaurant in Cartmel in Cumbria, along Clume, which everyone thought they were going to get their third star for ages and just didn't. So, like, and like in every other guide, it was like the highest rated restaurant, all these things. So they do on the outside see, like, they tease it and string it out almost for as long as possible, because maybe that, you know, maybe that does that pushes sales and pushes interest. So maybe they were just like, let's pull the biggest tease with Noma, but let's wait till they do fucking burgers or some shit, and then we'll give them three stars.
Mate, it's the timing that rings a bit odd to me. Like, if it was after, because I know that they're obviously working on the new menu and everything, like if it was after like a fully proper opening and into their stride again, I could understand that. It was like Noma 2.0, we're reopened, everything's happening, blah, 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 blah. But it was in this weird lull bit. It was just such an odd move.
Yeah, it kind of almost feels like they had this in their back pocket, and it's like, it's a bit of a down year. Let's pull the trigger on this one. Yeah. Get people on podcasts in Australia. We don't have a fucking guide talking about it.
It always comes back to us. Whatever it is that we're talking about, it's always coming back to us.
They're always complaining about
this
stuff.
This podcast worldwide, mate. I was just looking at the audience of this podcast. Yeah. Our second largest demographic is in Canada, not even New Zealand or England. Yeah, loving it.
Glad all my family, it's an interesting and friends one. Back home are listening.
I think that the one cool thing, and I don't know, like, fuck it, any day of the week, you can just head on over to Renee's or Noma's Instagram page and just see something that's still so interesting and innovative. Mm-hmm. Like, the fact that he's had the energy and the, you know, the drive to keep innovating after this long, like, you know, Noma 2.0 opened in 2018. I mean, they've been through COVID and had to adapt and things like that, but now they're back, you know, in full swing, and everything's just looking as cool and as interesting as it always has. Like, it's a pretty awesome thing. And, like, I don't know, as you say, Simon, basically the restaurant of that generation. Yeah. And like you mentioned, Sam, as well, it's basically developed food culture in Copenhagen and in Denmark that's like, I mean, it's got to be one of the top dining destinations in the world now, right?
I think you might have, if I had a guess from someone who hasn't been there and doesn't know anyone who reviews Michelin personally, possibly the consistency, because that is one thing Michelin bang on about, and all the chefs who win stars bang on about is consistency. And they obviously claim that they review multiple times and up to 10 times if you can get your second or third star. So with a menu that was always pushing boundaries and chopping and changing and all these things, then that might have been a knock against them. I mean, the other thing, maybe they just couldn't get a booking. It's taken them 15 years.
But I mean, you can have consistency in anything. It doesn't have to necessarily be, you mentioned about the chopping and changing and stuff, but the innovation is the thing that's been consistent. That sense of imagination is always been consistent. It doesn't matter that the menu changes seasonally or even mid-seasonally, they'll chop and change things. Like you said, it's that constant striving to innovate and think outside the box and do something different. It's like you saying to like Heston getting into like a lab and doctoring up some sort of Frankenstein meat fruit and going, oh, well, that's not really consistent because you haven't done that like on and on and on. It's like, it's that to me is the consistency in that sort of, it doesn't have to be, that's the way that I see it anyway. I'm not the one judging, but that's, if consistency is the question mark, that's what I would counter argue with that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it is interesting that like Heston's had 3 stars for how many years and his stuff's always pushed the boundaries in a slightly different way. And they've never had a problem giving him 3 stars, although I don't think his menu's changed in a decade. So maybe that's the consistency they're looking for, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting one. You try to put yourself into the place of someone dining at Noma as well, like a Michelin reviewer dining at Noma, and it's like you're used to sort of dining at X, Y, and Z place, and then you've come to Noma to review it. You're trying to review it according to Michelin criteria, and then it's just sort of this completely different experience where you're eating seals' dicks and like random, like, you know, shit, like then suddenly some fucking guy dressed as Zorro takes you to some field somewhere or whatever. I don't know what's going on over there. And you're like, how do I put the Michelin criteria into this dining experience? Like,
possibly a problem of sitting too far out of the box that the Michelin couldn't see it.
Yeah. Cool. Anyway, it's an interesting one. Congratulations, Noma. Congratulations, Renee. And
we know you listen.
Yeah. Shout out to Renee. Cool. Let's move along. Sam and Simon, you guys have some stuff to talk about when it comes to wine. Sam brought in, I mean, we've got some interesting, we've got a new season on the way. We're in spring. Sam, I'll let you take it away. You lead this one. I'm not the wine expert. You guys are. Go for it.
I love how wherever you set me up, I can just segue into things. So talking about things that are outside the box, I don't know if you saw on Ty Tate's Instagram.
I'm obsessed with his Instagram this lockdown.
Anyone that's listening
funniest
to this,
man.
If you're not following Ty and watching his videos, you are missing out on daily bouts of joy because he is just hilarious. He is also, on top of that, a down-to-earth kind human being. So, Ty, if you're listening, we love you. But he did a review of a wine from Dormelona that's been co-fermented with hemp seeds. I highly recommend watching it because the review is awesome. but it led me to thinking about those that are making wines, especially coming into spring and summer. And when we talk about aromatics more than anything, especially with like Riesling and Gewürztraminer, other ways that we can get aromatics into wine. And so Dormelona's done a co-ferment, and I did speak to Joe from Dormelona out in, so she's based in Margaret River in WA, but gets a lot of fruit from the Swan Valley as well. That's my pro tip for this year. If you haven't tried any wines from the Swan Valley, try them because there are some spectacular things coming out of basically Western Australia's oldest wine growing region. Mm. It gets overshadowed by Margaret River all the time. But yeah, so Joe's done a co-fermented Semillon with hemp seed. So it spends, it's about 10 kilograms of hemp seed, she said, she added to the ferment and spent 3 months on skins in a concrete egg and then pressed into barrel and then no sulfur, no additions, whatever, into bottle. And there's a few other people that are co-fermenting aromatic wines like Riesling, Semillon, Gewürztraminer with other things, you know, so it's not quite vermouth, but it's not quite your standard average wine either. You know, Sam from VHS Wines in down in SA, so down Adelaide Hills way, is the king of co-fermenting weird things together. And he's done a Gewürztraminer, or one of his Gewürztraminer projects, and he's basically, it's a 3 week fermented, and then he's locked in the ferment with cherry wood smoke for 8 months, which he self describes it as a wine that brings up childhood trauma, apparently. So I don't know if you people want to drink. I don't know if that's the best selling point for it, but it is incredible, and it is for me. This is what gets exciting about Australian wine. So, for those that don't know, I think the last time I was on the podcast, I mentioned that I was taking over as drinks writer for Australian Gourmet Traveller. So throughout all the columns this year, we've been talking about Australian wine and different Australian wine regions. And we're now hitting sort of that 12 month of me doing the column. And I've realised that this has kind of become my love letter to the Australian wine industry and the nuance that we have here in this country, because we're not controlled by Appellation controls. We can be at the forefront of innovation. And I'm not saying that everybody is going to start fermenting with different things, but it's pretty exciting that we have the possibility and the potential to be able to do that and to make a delicious wine that isn't necessarily about talking about a place. It's talking about a memory or a flavor or something just really cool.
What was your, it's kind of been trickling along for a couple of years now. There was the was it Brave New Wine? Someone else from WA did the aromatic Riesling.
Yep, the Aromatico. And Taris did a Riesling fermented with plants from the garden. So he just basically got his kids to go out and just pick different things from their garden and threw it into the ferment. No rhyme, no reason. And it was delicious.
So we've been seeing them for a little while. What was your first reaction to them? So I think, like, for a lot of people, and even myself a little bit, it's kind of like, oh, well, is that wine? Like, and you sort of think about, like, where is it classified, and am I on board with this? Where did you sit when you first sort of seeing these wines come along?
It's funny. It's my uni degree art history brain kicked in, and it was with that whole is this wine question, because you're obviously going to ask it. You're like, is this wine or is this vermouth? How are we rolling with this? And then it was like, well, it's wine because they've said it's wine. Is it good? Is it good is subjective. I enjoyed the ones that I tried. Is it going to fit in every list that I write? Absolutely not. You know, but there are times where I just want to try something interesting and cool and different and makes me think. You know, if I want to go have a champagne and a burger, I'll go do that. But if I want to go have, you know, this is the nuance of Australian wine and innovation, and, you know, they're not always going to get it right, but at least they're giving a crack. And if I don't like it, I bet you there are 10 other people that will.
Yeah. I think I had to kind of just drop that question altogether, because it was, at the end of the day, it was a pointless question to ask, but it's something that obviously still comes up. And for me, it was like, well, people do it in beer already and it's not seen as a bad thing. And, like, you know, how many different mixed drinks are there? They're amazing. And, you know, how many drinks that are sort of now classics probably started as something of like, you know, vermouth starters. Oh, this is wine with extra booze in and smelly stuff. So, like, yeah, was there a backlash there? So I think it's to kind of forget the question and just try and enjoy these drinks as they are. And especially VHS Sam stuff, it's kind of pretty wild and kind of mind-blowing the sort of vision he has for some of these flavors and some of the things he's put in. And I mean, like, I think maybe the thing that turned me around was one of his wines we had at Parrot. I can't remember which one, but it just smelled of native thyme. That just came up and I was just like, oh, that's cool. And that obviously got me hooked a bit then, because I was like, that's a flavor, you know, and a smell I've never had in wine before. And it, in some ways, that kind of gives it more of a sense of place of Australia when you've got these native ingredients as well. So I think that's an interesting part to kind of bring terroir in.
Can I ask two questions?
It's your podcast. Yeah. You can ask as many questions as you want.
I'll give you three if you want.
Wine expert. Okay, I'll start with two. I'll give you another one if you need it.
Yeah.
Can you put me in the mind of a one of these winemakers and
not Sam's? No.
Just
we love you, Sam, but I don't want to spend any time in your brain.
What's the decision making process around, you know, like what to chuck into which ferment and things like that? Is this, you know, technique a case of like, well, hemp sounds good, like, or kids, go out in the garden, let's give that a crack. Like, is it kind of experimentation, or is it more so like, look, we think that this type of grape has X, you know, character to it that could be nicely complemented by, you know, this, and we're just going to try it. You know, like, or is it a combination of all these things, like do all these sorts of different
what
things?
What was Joe's thought process with the hemp sem?
I asked her and she didn't reply. I was like, so what's the thought process behind this? And she didn't reply. And I was like, okay, probably safe not to know. I think, you know, I've had obviously long talks with Sam because I find what he's doing absolutely fascinating. And he will also be the first to admit that he doesn't always get it right, but he's trying and he's experimenting, and it's kind of like the chicken and the egg question. It's, you know, it's experimentation to see what works. It's looking at aromatics and looking at flavors in a completely new out of the box way. It's just doing something interesting and different. And like you said, like, I like the smell of native thyme. Well, let's chuck some of that in there because that complements Semillon or Gewurz or whatever, you know, because obviously those grapes have certain characteristics as well. So how can we enhance them, or how is it, you know, it's the same thing we talk about with food and wine matching.
So maybe the answer to that question is, because why not? And because experimentation's fun, and we like drinking wine. And we like,
I think people, especially if you're creative and you're making something, everyone wants to fuck around a bit. You know, chefs trying to put, you know, weird combinations and see what works on a dish. And you know, there's not a single fruit around that a brewer hasn't stuck in a beer of recent. I guess it is just kind of like why not, because like, I could. They're interesting wines, and they give, like Sam said, kind of give you maybe it's a pure flavor thing, so you're not worrying so much about you know, where it's from and how it is made. You're going, you know, what flavors are in this wine, so maybe it just gives you a kind of a different insight into or different kind of taste experience.
Okay, second question. As you said, all brewers throw fruit into beer and all that sort of thing, but like, so for me, I mean, my perception may be incorrect, but like, if I see a guava sour on a tap somewhere, like, I might be inclined to give it a crack if I feel like it, you know what I mean, if it's a hot day. But if I'm going to have six beers, I'll probably have five Newtowners and one guava sour. And if I'm buying a slab of beer, I'm not buying a slab of guava sour. Do you think that the, you know, the selling aspect of these wines will be a similar dynamic to that? Or... is, are things, you know, likely or liable to be found that are like, this combination is something that's fucking banging and it's going to stick around and people are going to know the old Pinot and, you know, whatever, co-ferment.
I mean, these wines are about as niche as you can get. Okay. This is like niche for Soms. Like, so there's, and I mean, I don't think anyone's making massive quantities of them. A lot of the VHS bottles came in like 500 mils, I think they were, which is probably a good idea.
Yeah, and by the time Sam sent me samples, they were already sold out.
Like, great.
Thanks. Great.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, his wines are pretty good, kind of cult following. So I guess if people who are making these wines make a barrel and it sells, they're happy with that.
I mean, shout out again to Ty and his Built to Spill company. He is getting some of Joe's hemp Semillon. So if anyone wants to try it, get on it quick because there's sweet FA.
Have you tried it? Have you tried it yet?
No. Sam? No, I haven't. But Joe did send me a bunch of stuff that I've got to look at. So I'm kind of hoping there's a sneaky one in there.
You have to let us know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows how? Who knows? Like, I guess the first brewer to throw, you know, a Black Forest cake into a ferment.
I bet that's a beer.
You know, that was quite. Oh, there is. Oh, definitely. There is. Moondog. Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, you wouldn't make. Okay, right. Well, maybe we should play a game of real beer or made up beer.
Yeah, that'll be a good one for the next one, right?
It'd be impossible.
But I guess, like, I guess what I mean is like, that you know, that movement probably started as niche as where wine is now. So it'd be interesting to see how it proliferates.
I mean, I think the parallel there with beer is that breweries now kind of have to do a constant production of special one-off beers that they kind of have to do because that's what the beer heads buy. You know, they'll come in and buy this new beer they've released. They've kind of read an article where they've sort of got themselves in this trap where they've got to constantly make these new wacky beers. Like, I had a Powerade beer the other day. I can't remember who made it. It was fucking gross. Like, it was blue. Like, I couldn't do it. Couldn't get my head around it. So, like,
I think that's just blue drinks in general. Remember when Pepsi brought out the blue Pepsi and everyone freaked out?
Yeah. There was there was another one. What's Nick Tazar's liqueur range from Melbourne? Medini, the other one. Anyway, there's a blue Curacao beer that I tried in a pub in Hunter. Wasn't about it.
Yeah, blue is not a color you want to be drinking unless you're like at the dentist or something. Maybe
I don't even like blue Powerade.
I actually don't mind blue Powerade, to be honest.
Red all the way, mate. Red Powerade, though. Fruit juice.
Cool. All right.
Stefan, did you have any other...
Interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah. Did you have any other wine questions? You said you might have a third. Do you have any other wine questions whilst we're chatting wine?
Whilst we're on wine, we've got Sam here. We shouldn't move on from wine just yet. Sam, what's any releases that are about to happen or have happened recently that you're particularly excited about?
I mean, sorry, to be honest, I have been deep diving into bubbles and sparkling at the moment for the November feature in GT. So my whole past 3 weeks has literally been immersed in everything bubbles, from champagne to Pet Nat and Ancestral, which has brought me quite a lot of joy in lockdown. Yeah, and from the neighbors at all this booze that keeps showing up.
what bubbles should we be celebrating the end of lockdown with then?
There's actually, okay, so hot pro tip, there is one from that Andrew Gard that Gardy brings in, and it's called, it's funny, it's from Cedron in France, which is just south of Jura. It's 100% Chardonnay done in that, you know, ancestral pet natty kind of style, but it's not it's not funky. It's pretty clean. Mm-hmm. And it's called Aussie. It's AUSSI. And it is just phenomenal. It's only $43 and it was just punching above its weight in terms of like quality and flavor, and could easily drink many bottles of it in summertime when it gets a bit warmer. So amazing. that's my
and when we're open.
Yeah. And when we're open. Yeah. Yes.
Lock in your allocation now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone hit up Guardian.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Simon, you got any more wine questions for Sam before we move on? We haven't got much left, so.
Well, that was going to be my question: was what you're going to drink when we get out of lockdown? What's your first drink? But okay. we'll go with Bubbly Jura.
Bubbly Jura. Bubbly Jura. South of Jura.
Is that the most somme answer you could have come up with?
What?
Yeah. Bubbly Jura.
Found this little bubbles. It's just south of Jura, and
smaller place.
Small little place. Yeah, it was probably a very some answer, wasn't it? I'll give you a non-some answer.
Okay.
I will be mainlining Aperol Sours as soon as you open again.
Nice.
Just give me a burger and an Aperol Sour, and I'm going to be really happy.
Yeah, amazing.
Is there any last one, Sam? Yeah. Is there any cool wine stuff that's been like? Is there any? I don't know. Like, I mean, in the same way that restaurants have adapted and provided these interesting sort of delivery services or offers or anything like that, has there been anything like that going on in the wine world during lockdown here in New South Wales, you know, in the same way? Has there been any interesting pivots, any interesting changes?
Well, I mean, the wine world hasn't really shut down, you know. No. I mean, God bless them, but all bottle stores are still essential services. You can go get your jab and then have a little six pack of something delicious. I do love that say like people like Ella at Native Drops or Stuart Fix are doing curated six packs for people. So you just give them a budget and they'll make you up a six pack of something cool. I've seen a lot of that, which I really like because it shows sort of innovation in drinks of what this particular person thinks is really interesting that you might like. So there's that, obviously that community human aspect to it, which I like, but I mean, everybody's still open technically, you know, to be able to buy.
Are people selling as much wine? Like, I mean, what's the impact on the sales? Are people just drinking the same amount of wine, but they're drinking it at home now?
Yeah, it was the same, exactly the same as last lockdown. I've seen figures from some of my clients who are obviously still selling, and it's astronomical what they're selling and making. It's in a very good way, kind of thing. But it's like you said, it's exactly what happened last lockdown, which was everyone is still drinking the same amount, and we've seen the Morgan Ray stats on that. But they're just doing it in one destination, which is at home, as opposed to spread out amongst the pubs and restaurants and things like that.
Mm. Cool. All right,
Steph.
Shall we move on?
Yeah.
Look, yeah, I've only got one little, like, I mean, that was a fantastic one, Sam. But, I mean, this is usually the section where we do the cool little things that we've noticed on Instagram. And basically every time John Raleigh from Textbook Patisserie, who's an alumni of this podcast, puts up a post from his Bush River kitchen, I'm just like, fuck, John, where is my invitation? I want to come to wherever you're. It's on the Hawkesbury River somewhere, and he's done his own little Instagram page for it. It's called Bush River Kitchen. And he's got a Argentinian grill and a wood fire pizza oven, and it's just like in the middle of the bush somewhere. I mean, he's such a good baker that he's just doing these absolutely epic pizzas, amazing grilled game meat that he's probably killed himself, and then using the residual heat in his pizza oven to bake amazing bread. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, I don't know. It just looks really nice. Like, that's a fucking, and like, he's tagging lockdown life, of course.
If someone like was enjoying lockdown, like, life. Yeah, it looks like he's quite enjoying lockdown life. Like,
that's a little bit further outside of my 5Ks.
Yeah, yeah. If anyone's enjoying it, yeah. As always, is fascinating social media does John have? The mixture of beautifully crafted patisseries and then butchering a deer in a field. Like it's, yeah. it's quite jarring it's between
balance.
The two.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
a balance.
Yeah, and it'll be yeah. one after the other as well. You'd be like clicking through and you'd be like, oh, oh pastry, oh, another croissant. Oh, my book. Oh, fuck.
Yeah,
amazing as always.
Just it's the pizzas that get me, man. You've got to check them out and just look at his pizzas. They
I saw. So I didn't realize it had its own Instagram page. I saw one of the pizzas on his page. I didn't realize he'd.
Yeah, he's putting. Well, he's putting stories. He's putting up stories of the food that he's making, but you can't really see the videos. Like he doesn't put the videos up as posts. But like I was just watching these stories of this pizza, like. Cooking in 30 seconds in like real time, basically in his story, and just coming out piping hot with the most delicious looking dough and crust and truffles all over it and stuff, and it just looked great. And I'm like, I want to go there. So, John, I've got my hand up. Please invite me to the Trevor Kitchen.
We're there.
As an aside, considering we're talking about John and who used to be in those, like he used to do those like. Patisserie competitions where they make all this wild stuff out of like marzipan and chocolate and things like that. I think people are going a little bit too far with the create. No, maybe not too far, but like I was just scrolling through
gone too far.
The other day.
They've
gone too far. I watched a 40-second video of a guy make a cello out of chocolate the other day. And I'm like, what are you doing?
Like Patrick Griolette or something? Like,
probably, yeah.
I've seen that guy on Facebook and I was like,
yeah. Incredible. Like, it's completely pointless, but it's incredible. Yeah. What did he do the day? It looks like a fan. And you're like, that's amazing. That you're like, why? Like, it looks so realistic. And he does like all the parts. Like it's like he's like an engineer as well. Yeah. He's got like the bits down. Does he like the electrical work on the inside?
Yeah. Like, honestly,
so like, over the top.
like an engineering degree and like to do a trade before he could like make his dessert.
It's just so over the top, but like, I can't not watch him if it comes up.
I know. It's like, and that's the thing. It's like I got to the end of this video and I'm like, what am I watching?
Yeah. I have to watch him like two or three times. It's like they go quite quick and I'm like, fuck, what did you do there? And you're like yeah. Great content.
Anyway.
But fucking hell. that work.
Let's finish it off. Have we got a tip each? Sam, have you got a tip for us?
Yes. Of like someone to like watch? Is that what the tip was?
Someone to watch or, I don't know, tasting wine, anything.
Well, I've already given my hot tips on things to try and things to drink. So My tip on someone to watch is if you haven't done it already, go subscribe to Jess Ho's monthly newsletter. She's an incredible writer based in Melbourne and has this knack of using hilarious anecdotes and the antics of her family from childhood to now to talk about not only food, but to talk about like larger cultural social issues. She's really big on sort of using that as an like to talk about cultural appropriation and things like that. And she's also given me a newfound appreciation of the humble white rice just from reading her newsletter. She is brilliant and she's really funny and has now given me the understanding of why congee should never be tripped up. So I highly recommend subscribing to her monthly newsletter.
Amazing.
How do we do it?
She is Jess Ho on Instagram, and you can just click on the link on her profile and go to it. Cool. It's really, really funny.
Easy.
Simon, you got one?
My hot tip is book your restaurant outings soon.
Yeah.
Because we're all going to be low capacity, so 1 per 4 square meters inside, which can be absolutely fuck off with some people, and there's going to be a massive outflow of people wanting to eat dinner. So if you want to eat dinner in the first month or two of reopening, I would book early. Also, it will just give us a little bit of confidence that we're going to have some customers. So it'll be nice for the restaurant to know they've got a full house to open to, and you won't miss out and be sad.
Yep.
That's a
hot tip.
Great tip.
Hot take.
Great tip.
Love it.
Mm.
My one is, I'm going to read it from what I put it in our little briefing email. Basically, it is, listen to whatever Adam Liao has to say and take it as gospel because he's smarter and more thoughtful than you.
I don't know. I do not see any fault in that or any word of a lie.
Okay, good. I'm glad you agree, Sam.
He seems so nice.
He's just so good in every way. He went to Wales once
and cooked some Welsh food. Like, he just seems so nice.
Love it.
Yeah, and like, look, if I don't know, I can't remember what I was trying to cook. Like, so I was trying to cook like Hainanese chicken or something like that. And like, if there's a sort of a recipe like that where you're like, oh, like I sort of know the basics, but I don't know the timings or those sorts of things. If like Adam and I will have a recipe for it, and it'll fucking work every single time. And yeah, like, and just sort of thoughtfulness, his knowledge of food history and things like that, and just little tips on really good, efficient ways to make things easy for yourself in the kitchen is really, really cool as well. So I don't know. I just reckon people who don't follow Adam Liao's stuff don't, like, I mean, I watched like his YouTube series just on making ramen is like an 8-episode saga and stuff like that. It's just so much epic depth. So yeah,
he's got that new show. Is it called The Cook Up or
The Cook Up? Yeah,
yeah.
And that's a good one as well. It's on SBS, and you can get it on SBS on demand. Yeah, and yeah, all full of great people, great recipes, and lots of great, you know, cooking tips and food and stuff like that. So. Thank you, Adam. Thank you for everything that you've given me. I love you.
And thank you, Adam Liao.
I think that'll do us.
Yeah, wrap it up.
I think that's it, guys. Sam, thank you so much. Can't wait to enjoy a just south of the Jura bubbly with you once we're open in a sunny Sydney park or something like that.
That sounds like a plan, my friends.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me on this very windy, dreary Tuesday night here in lockdown in Sydney. Cool. I miss you both. Mm. It's good to see you.
We miss you too.
And I second that. Bubbles and burgers in the park as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much, Sam.
Thanks, guys.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.